sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
U.S. jobs, best estimates. Apple's trade-in policy, what's that all about? The latest China data is disastrous, and our guest, Tadas Viskanta, is with us today on episode number 317 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And here we are, another week, another crazy market condition that has been going on, and we did see some very controversial numbers of when it comes to U.S. economics, and it is a very interesting market. You know, we've been talking about how over the last several months, we've been seeing this divergence when it comes to looking at the data. When we see on the economic side of employment, well, things are a little bit better, and you see things in the housing area that's better, but yet manufacturing has been very weak. On the other hand, consumer confidence is high, and yet we're seeing a variety of this push me, pull me kind of action going on right now. U.S. jobs were up 175,000, beating estimates, and the unemployment rate also went up to 7.6%. And that's going to fluctuate around a little bit here and there. And of course, we know we still have a pretty low labor participation rate, but it did come up a little bit. So that may be because the reason why we're seeing the increase in the unemployment rate. Now, one of the things that happened, if you were watching that, it was fascinating because once the number hit the tape at 8:30 in the morning on Friday, things got really haywire. Things went crazy. The yen plunged, the dollar moved. There was movement in the oil markets. Equities went crazy down. No one knew what to make of this particular report because if you look at the report, expectations were for about 165,000 jobs created and a 7.5% unemployment rate. Big question was, hey, if the number came in really weak, then what would happen? If it came in really strong, what will happen? And if you remember my thesis from last week, we talked about if the numbers come in really bad, or they come in really good, markets probably don't stand a chance of doing well because it's both of those are not good. You know, I really didn't discuss, honestly, what happens if it all came right down in the middle of the estimates and there was no surprise there, because really the change from about 168,000 of expectations to 175,000, I don't think that's a significant amount of a number to say that, hey, it came in as a big surprise or a big disappointment. So now what we're looking at is numbers right on the button pretty much, and markets at first didn't know what to do. They were kind of, well, what do we do now? Do we sell? Do we buy? What's happening? The Fed's not going to come in. The Fed is going to come in. So now we have a situation where markets are kind of moving around and not knowing what to do, and all of a sudden they took off. The yen turned around, hightailed into the weakening area once again. The dollar was kind of moving from where it was, which was very weak, to in the middle. And so, you know, things played out, and it was a overdue bounce that was something that I think was probably necessary. Don't know how long that's going to hold because there are a lot of other mitigating factors that are happening around the world that we're going to get into and talk about because these are important things. And I want to talk about some individual positioning and some things that I think are very important to take a look at as well in this episode. So what are those mitigating factors? What's going on? You know, you remember I've been talking about how things are getting a little bit wonky looking. I use that word a lot when it comes to things that just don't make any sense. And when you have the European area really slowing down significantly. And then on top of that, you have just a moderate to a benign growth in the U.S., and everything is predicated on central bank funding. And then you have also in Asia things going a little crazy, obviously, with Japan moving up so significantly because of the drop of the yen. And then the disappointment that we saw last Sunday due to the fact that the when Abe came out from Japan came out with his, what do you call it, the third arrow. They're so poetic. Third arrow of his plan to change the fiscal environment. Remember we said there was all this monetary action going on? It was like this gigantic dud. Because he said, we're thinking about doing this. We may do this. We may do this. We may do this. And we have nothing now. I'm like, what? Wait a minute. What, you come out with a big announcement, a big speech. It's like a band going on stage and you're all ready, you know, and they just stand there. No music comes out. And all of a sudden, everybody's like, wait a second. I thought there was going to be this third arrow. Well, now there seems there's going to be a... it seems there's going to be a second component of the third arrow. Now we're starting to get into derivatives. So I wonder if we're going to get like the second subsection A of the third arrow and amendment to number one. Who knows? This is getting crazy. They're buying time. And it was very apparent when they actually talked about it, when the news came out, and they said all the things that they said, because what I heard very loud and clear was they were not really ready for prime time. They weren't ready to come out with something, and that's kind of, I'm going to read some of this to you, what came out actually on the wires as it came out. And this is the, I don't even want to call it the pretend and extend. You want to talk about just the idea that trying to instill confidence is something that's really important. Whatever you want to call it, it was not a really well-executed plan. So on Sunday night, or on the 9th it was, at 12:30 at night, he comes out and he aims to win majority jointly with the new Comito, which is the party issue, political issue, okay? Now, the basic thing is he's going to base his tax decisions on economic statistics. And he's making some final decision on the rising tax and for consumption. So let's see what he says. He basically says that he is going to be running for government, and that's going to be, you know, something that he wants to have. And he's unveiling his second growth strategy in the fall now. In the fall. So what he did was he made the market believe that there was some magical third arrow, whatever that means, you know, the third arrow of the quiver. Are there any more, by the way? Is it just three? And why does it have to be three? But this is the third part of the plan that he outlined in the beginning. First one was basically talk it up to you blue in the face and try to get the yen moving. The second one was to do what you can to drop the monetary base as much as possible, buy as many bonds as you can. And the third part is the fiscal policy. I am still pretty negative on Japan. I told you that we were short. We were short the JGB, the bonds. We were short the Nikkei, and we were short the yen. Now, realize something, that shorting the yen, we're long the yen, looking for the yen to actually strengthen. Now, you realize something, there's a bit of hedge in there, because when we're short the Nikkei, oftentimes what will happen is if the Nikkei falls, you'll see that the yen will also strengthen. Now, if I am making money on one, I may lose money on the other. But this is basically a hedged position in going, saying that the equities have run too far. Now, they have come down about 13% since their high. We did move in and out of them a few different times through ETFs on the short side. And then Friday, lo and behold, there was a magical movement in it, even though the yen hit 94 and change. Remember, it was 103. 94 and change. On Friday morning, right after that jobs report came out, and then it came back to the 96 range or so, and that was good, and they were very excited about it and obviously pushed their futures up about 4%. But we moved in, like I said, moved in and out, took some profits, moved back in again. I'm still pretty negative on it, sorry to say. One of the things that adds to my negativity on this is the reality of what we saw, which was shocking over the weekend. Because China came out with their import and export numbers. Now, just to give you the backstory on this, we talked about how, remember, hey, wait a minute. China may be double counting their imports and exports, or at least not counting them correctly. Well, how's that? Well, one of the problems is that there's some restrictions on the amount of money and amount of different financial assets that you can actually bring into the country. Now, that being the case, they got creative. Very creative. And what do? So some of the money that was being brought in was being reclassified as imports, and some of the money that may have been going out as exports, and all of a sudden the numbers get really out of whack. Now I did put on the show notes for this episode, of go to the disciplinedinvestor.com, It'll be right on the top there on the left next to my picture and the podcast information of the latest podcast where you can see at all times right on the Disciplined Investor. I put the trend for imports and exports. And if you look at it just from a chart standpoint, you're going to be like, what is that? Because the exports plummeted to a 10-month low and imports unexpectedly fell as a crackdown on fake trade invoices exposed weakness in global demand. So what happened was that overseas sales only rose about 1% from a year earlier when expectations were like, you know, for 14%. Imports dropped 0.3% when they thought they were going to be up, and that left a trade surplus of about $20 billion. Now, the real question and the thing that is still very hard to discern, are we comparing this year over year to the fake numbers? Are we comparing the year over year to the real numbers? So far we know one thing. We know that there's a correction being made in how they're calculating. Is that right? We have no idea either. Are we just tracking this and saying, well, these are the real numbers? Why in heaven do we think these are going to be the real numbers if the real numbers weren't there before? Are they for the crackdowns? Or did they go to the other side and say, you know what, too many things that were previously said to be imports, exports are now off the list when they really should be on the list? So I think the data is pretty much unusable. We really, even though it says it and it's in writing and it's in the news, it's all over. You'll see if you go on the web, you'll see, oh, China, you know, economy is plunging and blah, it's bad because of this and that. At the end of the day, it is not as good as was, you know, just how long ago? Within the last year, let's say. It is not as good as everybody thought it was. Let's get that straight. 14, 15%. Remember, 2 months ago, there was like 18%. We're like, well, how in the world? How in the world did 18% when we see, if they're exporting 18%, but yet we're seeing on the other side of the equation, the numbers don't match on the imports. How does that happen? So there's some funny business going on here. And the problem is that this could be one of, you know, two things. If there is some, what would it be called? I guess the reality and substance behind these numbers, we have a problem. But again, I think we have to wait a little while to see actually how it plays out. I am not happy. I am not at all pleased with the way that they have been reporting and that they're allowing some of this to happen. And no, more than that, I'm not happy with what these numbers look like now. Very poor. And we're not talking about, you know, a change and a revision from 1% to 2%, which is a big. We're talking about 15%, 16% exports and imports on a year-over-year basis, and now we're at one or negative. That's a plunge. Terrible. But unfortunately, the lack of transparency and the fact that we'll never really know is something we have to just deal with. Now, the bulls will say, hey, you know what? This is a one-month thing, an aberration. We're not sure of it. And you know what? We don't know the comparisons, all that. The bears will say, hey, I told you so. The neutral parties that we like to be, right, that you want to be as best as you can, are going to scratch your head and say, I really don't think I could use this data. But I'm going to err on the side of caution because it's not really the best thing here. And at the same time, it is the data, so we have to follow along and deal with it. Now, also what's happening that leads me to believe that there are some problems is the treasuries are dropping. Yields are coming up significantly. They were being sold off like crazy last week. So some of the biggest declines in treasuries that we've seen in years, and the same thing is happening around the world to a degree. This whole run for safety and run for yield and all that is starting to break up a little bit because many of these countries have a unsustainable amount of debt that's outstanding due to the fact that they keep on printing money and buying all the debt that they can. One day, if they're not careful, they're going to get smacked in the face really hard with the fact that, hey, wait a minute, let me get what we just did. We just took out more debt at an adjustable rate, kind of like what happened back in the 2000s. There was no, you know, nobody watching over. We could do as much as we want, and adjustable rates, and all of a sudden they're going to ratchet up without our ability to lock in. Ooh, very bad. And, oh, wait a minute, I remember this. Yeah. We said this shouldn't be happening again, but we just did it ourselves. So the government is just basically going along with the program that was happening in the mid-2000s that pretty much wrecked the economy by simply doing the same thing. Because it is an adjustable rate mortgage, it's out of their hands, and basically the banks, which are the investors in this case, are able to raise their rates as much as they want on this. Crazy. Then we have gold. We saw that the Rubini, we talked about this on the DH Unplugged podcast last week. Rubini. Anyway, Rubini. He came out with a projection that by 2015, gold is going to be 1,000. Now, I'm hard-pressed for anybody to believe anybody that really can project things more than a month, 2 months. Very difficult, really, because there's so many moving parts right now inside of all of the economics and earnings and governments and all the things that are happening on a global basis that you can't tell what's going to happen that long of a period of time. But anyway, he's coming up with his prediction. I guess it's one of his, you know, last-ditch efforts to prove that, you know, he is able to predict very well. Now, we saw a very harsh movement again. You know, gold has been trading between the range of about 1322 to about 1415, 16, 17, something like that. And on Friday, when the quote-unquote better-than-expected jobs numbers came out, which is a very, you can't say that with a lot of conviction, gold started to move around pretty dramatically. Now, it moved around also with the dollar, moved also with the yen. And again, don't think I'm nuts, but the fact is that the currency markets are the tail that's wagging the dog these days. So you got to keep very close attention to that right now. It's not always this way, but these days, very much the case that they are leading the markets around by the nose. And gold traders who are the most bullish since the market drop and the bear market of gold began, and we know that by the Commitment of Traders report that comes out on Friday, got punched in the face pretty bad on Friday when gold dropped about $35. Came down really hard, so did silver. Now, miraculously, once again, the levitating oil, which is amazingly still above 90, when in fact we still have inventories that are at the highest level since about 80 years or so. There was a little bit of a better report last week, but at the same time, when you see the dollar that's rising and all the things that are going on around the world, it makes no sense that gold, that oil, came back from about a 1.5% loss on Friday that followed along all the other commodities and then turned around for about a 1.5% gain. So there is this, you know, a lot of liquidity in the system, and that's what's pushing a lot of this. And the bounce that we saw on Friday, that coincided and came right after the test of the 50-day line of the S&P 500 on Thursday. Don't forget something, that 50-day line is the basic line that institutions use as, hey, you know what, we'll wait till a pullback. If we get to the 50-day, we'll buy. Now, oftentimes, you'll see a lot of people that track the 50-day. We'll look at two things when it comes to the 50-day moving average. The first thing is, okay, what's the direction? What's the trend? Is the 50-day moving average on an upward slope or is it on a downward slope? Is it rolling over or is it rolling up? And when you look at the bounce and you look at the trend, right now, if you drew that 50-day moving average, it's trending higher. So when you get that move down to the 50-day, that's a signal pretty much, hey, you know what, maybe we'll take another shot at buying into this because so far we're not seeing a lot of rollover. Now, one of the things that we talked about, and I had some charts up on the Disciplined Investor over the last few weeks that was very concerning, was the Z-score, which is the standard deviation away from a particular long-term average. And the thing that we were looking at in particular was the 200-day moving average. And it was almost at an all-time high in the last decade of how far away from the 200-day moving average on a standard deviation basis the S&P was. And it came right back in, by the way. KRI indicator indicated a -4. Interesting that only stayed there for about a day. And it was very, very quick. And at the same time, we saw the 50-day moving average get breached on Thursday, then turn around as the buy programs came in. So if anybody was wondering what in the world We have this downtrend that's going on for a while, 3 weeks of down movements on the S&P 500 and on the markets in general. And all of a sudden, we get this turnaround with no news, nothing that's exciting. In fact, there was negative news. So what was that about? Well, it was about that the 50-day moving average, again, became a buy point. Very simple. They, you know, look around. They look at, oh, we got some money in the mutual funds, and investors are still generally buying. And, you know, there's negative news, but there's been a lot about that. Hey, you know what? 50-day average, you hit that, you just start going in and buying again, at least to support that level. That makes sense? Now, Apple, we have some news on that. I want to talk about that for a second. Apple has come out with, the stock has been just dogging it. Terrible. Just terrible. Now, one of the things about Apple that is interesting is they just came out with, two things. Cook came out with a commentary that wearable technology is going to be the next big thing. Wearable technology. That's, I guess, watches and implants, maybe. Who knows? Biometric style authorizations. And, you know, we're getting smaller and smaller, obviously, when we're talking about this. Now, you know, a watch is interesting, and a watch that's a computer kind of gets smart concept, you know, where you have these different, or James Bond, maybe, where you have these different devices that are smaller and smaller. They can collect data. They can do a lot of things. Okay, that's interesting. Question is it really going to be something that we're going to use? I question that. There are some benefits, yes, if it can hold a lot of data and it's easy to use and maybe nothing more than a storage device. That's kind of cool. So you take this little device with you, right? You go in your car and it's your Bluetooth and all your music's on there and all your address books are on there. And then it hooks up to another device that actually you can see that has some size to it, that actually has buttons that you can click very easily without, you know, just using a little pin or a tip of a pen to actually get to it. And that becomes the core of your data. And maybe for credit cards and things like that. That's interesting. I don't think that the device has the technology. It's not going to replace an iPhone necessarily, although it may interface with it so that you can synchronize when you come into your office with maybe your computer and things like that. That's kind of interesting. But I don't get the whole thing about how to make technology a computer on your wrist. So, but the other ones are kind of a cool idea. But Apple also has announced a trade-in policy. Don't forget they lost a recent court ruling with Samsung, and they're announcing a trade-in policy. This is something actually that was on their website for some time, but they're really trying to promote this right now to trade in your iPhone and get a new one to spur on some kind of demand. I guess many people didn't know that this was available, but you know, this really is a departure from the kind of marketing that Apple has done in the past. Think about it. Apple has always been the cool kid on the block, and you know, you went to Apple because they're Apple. And the price didn't really matter that much because there was no other competition. So they didn't have to do a lot of promotions. As a matter of fact, there was never a promotion. Maybe once a year there was something, and there was a back to school maybe, and there was a student discount and teacher discount, but that was about it. If you're just a poor schlub like you and me, you're paying full price. Nowhere else to get them discounted either, for the most part. Yeah, there was some trade-in policies and things like that, but honestly, nothing major. Well, this is kind of a departure, in my opinion, and it just doesn't fit well with the image that they're trying to portray. I think that it's really a mistake by them to try to go this route and try to cheapen it up and kind of have a sale concept. I know there's competition, but what they should do is, on their next device, lower their price point. Don't come out with a cheap device. Don't come out with a half device, you know, like a mini. Come out with a product, but just bring down the price ever so slightly. That's what I think about that. Now, I also want to talk about some of the things that are going on with some videos that we just put out recently on a couple different stocks. I want to talk about Tesla. There's something that has come into the news just this weekend on Tesla, and I thought it was interesting. I want to talk about some of the economics that are coming up. But before we do that, I want to talk with our guests, and I want to mention, of course, GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting is sponsoring this episode of The Disciplined Investor. And what is so great about GoToMeeting, you've heard me say it before, and if you're kind of sick of me saying it and you haven't gone to it already, you don't know what I'm talking about. You got to go and check it out because it's a really great product and because it just makes your life a lot easier. And simply with one click, all you have to do is you can share your screen. You can work on documents in real time, use a webcam, and interface with the people you're talking to, and even present from your iPad. And you can simply do what we do. We share documents with people we know and presentations and just screen share and then allow input and collaboration. And it really makes things much easier to deal with than trying to explain things in a ridiculously long email and then not really getting your point across and taking hours to do it. You just get your point across real quickly. You get the collaboration and input from others. Great stuff. So check out GoToMeeting. You get a 30-day free trial over at GoToMeeting.com. Click on the Try It Free button and use the promo code PODCAST. The promo code is PODCAST. I think you'll enjoy it and you'll get a lot of use out of it. So when we get back after we talk with Tadas, who is waiting, I want to cover a variety of things, plus a listener question about a particular stock that I thought was very interesting because there was a question about, hey, what's going on with this stock? Why is it plummeting? And I have some answers because you know, he said he didn't really have much to go on and didn't understand what was happening, the great dividend and all that, and we'll talk about that and some of the earnings that are coming up next week as well. Good stuff? Sure. I hope so. Hey, by the way, if you want to get your 14-day free trial of Trigger Point Research, where we have breaking up, where we're trying to look for really quick-moving, fast-moving stocks that are going to break out and move within a certain period of time very quickly or break down, it's your special day. 14-day free trial at TriggerPointResearch.com. You're going to like it. It's free for 14 days, and whatever that comes out and whatever alerts that are triggered, you'll get them, so you know, hopefully you make some money with it for free, and then I'm sure you're going to like the service, particularly in this environment where there's so much volatility right now, so much opportunity. And take a look at some of the videos we did last couple of weeks in the setup area, like Questcor, the day after it came up 6%. Went so fast, it was just a setup. It's still not where we wanted it to be, but it moved quickly, and you could have had some nice profits. Interesting. And with us today, Tadas Viskanta, who is a prolific writer, a great writer, actually, writes for his website, Abnormal Returns, and he has some great things to talk about, and we're going to find out some things that I think we all need to know today. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am great. Hey, you know, you've been writing a lot about financial literacy lately. What prompted you to kind of start really getting involved in that concept, kind of more lately than... and really digging into that?
Well, you know, it's a persistent problem. I don't think that there's, you know, I don't think there's any sort of magic bullet out there, but I think that it started in part when I was writing my book. I talked a little bit about financial literacy in part because, you know, my book was targeted kind of not necessarily for the beginning investor, but maybe this person who's read, you know, one or two books on investing and then is kind of looking to take that next step. And I think part of that, you know, trying to reach that sort of audience was what I was trying to do. And part of that is just recognizing this problem of financial illiteracy and how it's really so pervasive. And I think part of the problem for beginning investors that they just can't take those first steps. I mean, they're so either paralyzed by fear or really just don't have the education or understanding of investing that they're really just not able to take those initial steps in investing, which I think is kind of, I think we would all recognize those are very kind of, those first steps are really crucial for getting people kind of on the right path.
Now, is it because when you say that the investor, they're new at it, they really don't feel comfortable because they're, you know, out of their skill set and their understanding, or is it fear of losing money, all the above? You know, what's the biggest issue, do you think?
I think that it's certainly all of, I would recognize that it's all of the above. And I think that certainly the last decade or so in the stock market hasn't helped. I think anybody who has kind of dipped their toe in the waters in 1999 or 2007, has in all likelihood gotten, bitten. And, you know, they've either pulled all the way back and said, whoa, I don't want any part of the stock market. I've seen what it can do to you. Or they've seen other, you know, or they've heard horror stories from other people who have gotten hurt in the process. But, you know, I think, you know, financial literacy and financial illiteracy may be better defined, I think, is, you know, it's a challenge because it's building blocks. you start with kind of the very basics, you know, what it means, you know, what it means to live within your means, to save. You know, of course, you can't be investing until you've saved up some amount of money for whatever sort of goal you might have, whether it be buying a house, buying a car, saving for an education, you know, saving for retirement. So it's problems that, you know, you have to have all those building blocks along the way. And I think that really, I think part of the challenge is that I don't think the financial media focuses on the right things. The financial media, for their own purposes, focus on those things that are, high profile and kind of flashy and in the news and things that they can break in. You know, we have breaking news as opposed to, that's the kind of thing that they feel make, garner them readership or viewership or page views. Whereas the kind of the day-to-day of saving and investing, frankly, is kind of boring. You know, there's only so many different ways you can say, you know, spend less that you make, and, you know, that's not a very sexy topic, as it were. So, I mean, I think there's kind of a mismatch between what people need and what they're getting.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things you could see is that the Barron's cover page from last week had this big pot leaf on it. And I was saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, this is so... I don't know if it's out of character for them, but it's just so flashy, like you said, and it's so poppy. And the other thing about, I think I agree with you with the mainstream media, is that they make up reasons for things that may not actually exist. Stocks are down today because profit taking. Stocks are up today because, you know, they kind of, you go back and forth 100 times and with something, and you think that they know what they're saying, but the truth of the matter is they have nothing to say.
Right, no, that's just filling space. I mean, there's, you know, the day-to-day fluctuations of the market, trying to put any sort of rational explanation on them outside of some sort of catastrophic of, you know, geopolitical event is kind of a fool's errand. And I think, you know, those articles are you can easily skip by.
Yeah, I hear you. Let's talk a little bit also about the low-cost investing discussion, because there's been a lot of discussion over the years about active management and passive management, and those that are hardcore passive, which is a little bit different than low cost, of course, but passive management, I mean, they could pound the desk, and once they hear anything about picking a stock or a sector, they tune out, right? They won't even acknowledge it, you know?
There are hardcore adherents on on either end of the spectrum, and I would probably put myself somewhere in the middle there as well. And I think you're right to make a distinction between index and low cost. You can have high cost index funds, which are sold by some of the biggest brokerage firms, you know, in the country, that are charging 100 plus basis points for an S&P 500 fund, which we know is, you know, on the face of it, pretty ridiculous. And you can have low cost active management. So, I mean, I think that those are not mutually exclusive. So I think that's a pretty important distinction. But, you know, it's interesting because I've been thinking about it more and more as kind of ETFs continue to kind of roll on, and we've kind of passed the 20th anniversary of the introduction of the SPY, the S&P, the SPDR S&P 500 ETF fund. And, you know, it's an interesting topic because I think what ETFs did is they kind of popularized the idea of index investing. In part because, you know, you could argue that ETFs are a little bit of a better mousetrap. You know, you can trade them during the day. They have, you know, there are some potential tax benefits to having an ETF versus an open-end mutual fund. But I think what happened is it kind of took index investing and made it a more of a broad market sort of phenomenon. So before, you really needed to go to Vanguard to, you know, for all intents and purposes, Vanguard was the place you had to go to get index funds, which was great. Vanguard is obviously still the market leader and still does index funds and is still, on all accounts the cheapest. But what happened is by making index ETFs available to everybody, anybody with a brokerage account now could dip into that low-cost index sort of product line. So it kind of went from being a once, you know, you had to go to this single shop to get index funds. Now you could get it, you know, as long as you had a brokerage account, you could get it anywhere. And now in the last couple of years, you've had, most of the major brokerage firms have some sort of free, commission-free ETF trading. So it's kind of a double bonus. Now you have low-cost ETFs, and now in a lot of these places – You know, with some restrictions, you can trade a lot of those funds. You know, you can trade those funds for free. So it's kind of the best of both worlds in that regard. So I think you kind of opened up this idea of low cost investing to a much broader sort of to the broader public. And I think it's kind of, to that degree, it's kind of catching on. I think that we're now seeing kind of the fruition of that. People are now much more cost conscious on their funds, but also thinking about, you know, if that's the case, you know, if you buy into the idea that low cost investing at the fund level is important, well, then you kind of take the next step and say, well, what value added is my advisor adding? Is it, you know, are they worth what they're charging me? So I think it is kind of trickling through the entire investment management sort of arena. And I think, you know, it started with index funds. It's shifted into the ETF area, and I think it's beginning to trickle through. Obviously, there's a long way to go. There's still much more money in open-end mutual funds than there are in ETFs. There's still more money managed actively than it is passively. So I think there's certainly a long way to go, but I think kind of you're beginning to see this trend is kind of taking hold. And I think, you know, people in the investment management industry, whether it be as a provider or a user, are kind of coming to this realization that this is becoming a much more important sort of thing that they have to take in mind.
You know, one of the things, though, that is, you mentioned a couple of double swords there. One of the things that has happened also with ETFs, in my opinion, is because in the quote-unquote old days when you had index funds or actively managed mutual funds, you know, you had to wait till the end of the day, 4 o'clock to get out. And everybody was like, you know, everybody played along with that, right? And
right.
And then all of a sudden the ETF started coming out where you could trade them intraday. Now what's happening is if you have an ETF like the SPY, you are basically, your amount of money is trading a basket of stocks that is the S&P 500. Now when you take that to a very large degree, what's happening, of course, is that the masses are now trading the indices, right? So
correct.
Throughout the day. So adding to potential volatility, by the way. And then they came out with the doubles and triples, which have some benefits and subtractions, obviously, depending on, you know, how you're dealing with them. But do you think that the ETFs that are traded intraday has changed the, we'll even call it the time frames, but the investor psychology about markets versus, you know, long term staying in versus, hey, I'm just going to move in and out?
I think there's probably two effects. I think there's a bit of a mix shift. I think people who were, I think there's one class of traders who used to be trading Apple and Microsoft and Cisco, and now they trade the triple Qs just because it's easier. So I think, you know, I think from some perspective, it's just a mix shift. People who used to trade kind of the big liquid individual names now trade ETFs. So I think there's a little bit of that. But, you know, it's an interesting idea. I don't know that volatility is more. I think you certainly, like you said, you've opened up different sorts of opportunities. So, for instance, this year you've seen the currency hedge Japan fund, DXJ, garner just a huge amount of assets as the Japanese market has skyrocketed, and then you've seen a reversal. So I think that's the sort of thing that you wouldn't have seen 5 or 10 years ago, some sort of kind of an obscure sort of idea that kind of takes hold and money just kind of rushes into it and then rushes out of it. And, you know, for most, in all likelihood, there weren't a whole lot of people who were there for the big, you know, who caught the big chunk of that trend. A lot of it was money rushing in at the end there that has gotten hurt. So I think that you have, like you said, it is a double-edged sword. It opens up opportunities for people, which I think is great. But again, you've also, as you've opened up those opportunities, you also give that there's the opportunity there for people to make big mistakes as well.
Now, what about, you mentioned currency ETFs. We've seen a tremendous amount of movement in currencies, and obviously you could trade currencies through Forex or futures, but do you think it's wise or do you think it's smart, from a big picture, I'm not talking about down to the individual investor, but to have currencies traded through ETFs that can easily move markets so dramatically?
You know, the ETFs have really haven't taken off. If you look at the compared to equities or fixed income or even commodities, the amount of assets under management in the commodity ETFs is really just kind of a drop in the bucket. I mean, I think you're right. You see there's much more volume in kind of the cash markets or even in futures. I think that in regards to, you know, I think this is one area where ETFs really haven't been haven't been a particularly successful in terms of capturing assets in Forex. So, you know, I think that's maybe just because there's these robust other markets that it hasn't caught on. And I think part of that might be leverage as well, where, you know, you can get, you know, for those people who are really hardcore traders, they can get the leverage that they want in the in the cash market than they can in ETFs. And I think that, you know, and I think it's hard to say whether it's a good or a bad. I think that the cash Forex markets are, you know, some of the most liquid markets in the world. So from that perspective, you know, from a trader's perspective, it's not surprising that people like to play in those markets. But I think, you know, like everything else, volatility just has kind of gotten tamped down just in general. You have, you know, the volatility in Forex markets used to be a lot bigger, and it's kind of come down a lot. So, you know, I don't know that, I have a section in my book telling people to, by and large, to avoid Forex because it's, you know, at least in terms of, avoiding the high leverage that is likely to knock people out of those markets before they really have a chance to get too far along.
Well, the big problem is that you have to sleep, and that's where, you know, usually things go awry. You know, you're sleeping, and sometime during the middle of the night, something happens. By the way, mention your book and where you can get it, please.
The book is the same name as the blog. It's Abnormal Returns, Winning Strategies from the Front Lines of the Investment Blogosphere, and you can find it everywhere, including Amazon.com.
All right, so one thing I want to ask you in closing is this. You know, there's some discussion about opening up markets. Right now, U.S. markets, 9:30 to 4, after hours, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we have futures open pretty much 24 hours a day, Forex, same thing. There's some talk about extending the hours of the equity markets. And we already know that liquidity dries up after 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, unless there's some major issue happening with regard to a stock or earnings. What do you think about this idea of extending market hours?
I don't have a really strong opinion about it. I think, you know, the professionals have the ability to trade, like you said, 24 hours a day, whether it be Forex or fixed income or equities or futures. I think, you know, for those professional investors, they have that ability to do that. You know, I don't know that it really does a whole lot one way or another. I mean, certainly we have the technological ability to keep markets open 24 hours a day. But like you said, it's hard to keep liquidity for all but the most liquid and high profile names available. So in that sense, it's, you know, for the average investor, it's probably a net negative if you think that they're gonna spend if it dries up liquidity, if it spreads out liquidity during the day and it makes it more difficult to trade, then it's probably a net negative. But it's not really something I've spent a whole lot of time thinking about. But like you said, as people, you know, we've gone from, you know, people were satisfied with end of day pricing for their funds, and now we've kind of gone to intraday ETF liquidity, and it might very well be an inevitability that we go to 24-hour trading just because we have that. You know, it's just keeping the computers on a little bit longer. So in that regard, it may be an inevitability, but it's not necessarily necessarily a great thing for individual investors.
Yeah, I hear you. All right, Tadas, we'll talk soon. I appreciate you coming on and sharing some of this information about this. And I think that also one of the big things that people who are listening, that are listening to this, to learn some things and to kind of get into the idea of, hey, maybe I should be investing. I want to gather all the information I can before I do so, which I think both of us agree is a good idea, is check out his blog, abnormalreturns.com, because he is writing a lot about, you know, some of the things that you need to know about. And as he is focusing on the idea of different management styles, and one of the things that, you know, like what worked and what didn't. He had a recent article about financial innovation that once worked, and low volatility ETFs and time frame mismatches, and just a variety of things that really can help you. So I appreciate all that and you coming aboard today.
It was my pleasure.
All right, speak to you soon. Bye-bye. Now, in all seriousness, you should check out his blog and his writings. He's a very smart guy, very, very smart guy, and he does some great work on a variety of topics, talks about things in depth that you really need to know about. So check out abnormalreturns.com, and you can track him on Twitter as well. And you, just like you track us over here at Andrew Horowitz. One word, and just very easy to know and to find out. Let's talk about the economics, then we'll get into a quick listener question I think is very interesting. This week coming up, we do have some information that you need to pay attention to. There's going to be basically, I think, the core issue, aside from the wholesale sales and inventories, which are looking like they're going to probably dip a bit. We have retail sales. Now, retail sales have been pretty good. We know that the consumer has been holding up pretty well. But now we're in a position where, okay, all the sequestration is in, the tax has really taken hold, and there's a different, kind of a different flow going on. Even though consumer confidence is up, we have been seeing that earnings and wages are dropping. And retail sales, we have to look, the expectations are for a 0.3% gain, and that's as opposed to a 0.6% gain on the ex-autos and gasoline side of things. Now, of course, you're going to see a drop a little bit probably from last month in the gas prices. We did see that the gasoline prices have been rolling down a bit. But in the advanced retail sales, there is the thought still that we're going to see about a 0.4% as compared to a 0.1 last period. So all in all, there's still this hope that there's going to be a much better number when it comes out. And we have initial claims coming out on Thursday. So not a lot of really a lot in the beginning of the week. As a matter of fact, very little. We're really going to be dealing with the Japanese numbers that are coming out on GDP. And we'll be dealing with, of course, what does it mean with the China numbers. And then we have, at the end of the week, the producer price index, which, of course, is the precursor to the CPI that always comes out afterwards. It looks like we're going to see a slight rise in the producer price index. And that's the inflation on the side of businesses. Now, one of the things that businesses have been going and doing well with is the fact that prices have been coming in, and they've been seeing a pretty good amount of pricing relief when it comes to when they look at the input costs, and that's been good. We haven't seen inflation, you know, even though everybody's like, where is the inflation? We know there's inflation when it comes to Andrew going to the movies at $13.75 for Star Trek 3D, which was absurd. Family of four is like $90 to go to the movies if you're going to have popcorn and some drinks. And then on top of that, you have all the things that we know about that have gone up in price. But yet when we look at the official statistical number, we're seeing there's no inflation. No inflation in this market means only one thing, that the Fed can continue on printing money and buying bonds. That's the whole hope of everybody, to keep things rolling along as well as it does. We're going to see PPI. The expectations are for a significant increase from zero last period to 0.3%. Now, if you strip out the food and energy, we're talking about only a 0.1%. And then, probably more importantly, we're going to see the manufacturing and capacity utilization at the end of the week and the preliminary number from the University of Michigan on the confidence level, which is looking to stay the same as last month at 84.5. So, there are, I would say that the data points are really not as important this week as they were last week and last couple. It's kind of, you know, we get that ebb and flow of those that come in, and we are going to probably stay within this trading range for some time unless something really breaks dramatically. Now, I got an email from Bob, and he asked me this. Can you tell me why AT has moved to $5 from $11? When I look at all my sources and cannot find any reason for it, it pays a great dividend, and all its ratios are in line. Now, if we're looking at the same stock here, AT is Atlantic Power, and yes, I'll give you the agreement that there is a excellent dividend, or a good dividend, in the 8% range or something like that. Year-to-date change is about 58% on this stock. Market cap about $565 million. Good amount of short interest on this. Again, 8% yield. Now, I'm not sure where you're getting your numbers in terms of ratios. Because what we're seeing is that the estimated EPS, or earnings per share, is looking like it's going to be a negative 61 cents. That's first of all. Its five-year net growth of its dividends is down. Because, and I'll get to that, what happened recently that really took the stock down. Utilities, in general, have been going down, because rates have been going up a bit. But the biggest issue is that earnings have fallen off a cliff. If you look at the chart, we're going to put a chart on this episode's page when you go look over at the Disciplined Investor on the show notes. And you can see we identified where the dividends are and where the earnings are, et cetera. We'll put a couple of notes on there. But basically, there was a 39% dividend cut in February. Now, if you look at the chart, you'll see that coincides pretty well with that waterfall look of the chart where it went from about 11 down to about, you know, 5 or so. It's a class action lawsuit against the company because of the dividend cut. Debt is rising very fast. Their cash flow is pretty pathetic. It's actually negative. Their net income is negative on the cash flow statement. And what we're seeing is they're using depreciation as a way to offset in a big way and some losses, it looks like to us, taking much of their equipment down to pretty much nothing. And that's why they're holding up some of their earnings. They took a massive loss back in this year, and that is kind of moving things up. But also what we're seeing is that the cash flow is slowing down dramatically. The cash in the bank is holding okay, but they've been increasing their debt load dramatically. Now, we have a company increasing their debt load. We have a company that cut their dividend. We have a company that earnings look horrible. And in my opinion, when you add that to the fact that rates are going up, and this is a company that has indirect interest in non-utility electric generation facilities, and maybe that's going to be coal, by the way, which they're trying to shut some of those down. You put this whole thing into a giant bowl, you mix it around, and what do you get? You get a horrible concoction and some reasons why the stock has gone down. Now, if you're buying this for the yield, this is one of the big problems when it comes to chasing yield. Because when you chase yield, or when you're going after yield, you kind of get a little bit blinded by the fact that, hey, can a stock move down? You know, can a stock have a hiccup? Can, you know, why is the stock yielding this much? Well, one of the reasons the stock is yielding so much is because that investors are wary of this stock, and they're really concerned about the fact that, hey, are they going to have the money to pay the dividend in the future with the kind of cash burn they have and with the increasing debt load? So there are a lot of things that are going on negative here. So, Bob, I want you to check that, and you could write me, and anybody can write me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And I think that the biggest issue here is that when we look at the when you look at the balance sheet and you look at the price earnings ratios and the price ratios and you look at the cash flow statement, I don't see where you could have said, hey, you know what? There's a all the ratios are in line. Now, maybe I'm missing it. We use data through Bloomberg. I think it's pretty good. Now, if you would do me a favor and please send me on your data that shows me these ratios, I'd love to see it. But basically, the answer to your question is what's going on? They took a 39% drop in their dividend. And in this environment, that's not really taken too well by investors, okay? So, but yeah, it does have a good yield. And just be careful when you're shopping for yield. Anybody out there, when you're shopping for yield, you know that the underlying stock, if it is a stock, you know, has the opportunity to move. And bonds, too. We did see that dramatic move recently in bonds. So, you know, I think you want to pay attention to that. Hey, you know what I want to do? I want to give you an update of some of the things that are happening. We have a lot of great guests coming on in the next several weeks. Scott O'Neill from Investors Business Daily will be here in on next week, actually. Barry Ritholtz from The Big Picture. Always love talking to him. And from Fusion IQ in the following week on the 13th. Katie North from Bloomberg on the 30th. Jim O'Shaughnessy, author of What Works on Wall Street and founder of O'Shaughnessy Asset Management, July 21st. We also have Denise Schull, who is that neuroeconomist who we talked to before. Love her stuff. Is the author of Mastering Mind Games, Training for Psychology. She's on the 28th. And Matt Galgani from Investors Business Daily, who wrote a recent book, is coming on as well. And we'll have some other names in there as well throughout the time. All right. So I told you I was going to talk about a couple of economics, which we did. And I'm going to tell you I was going to talk about some of the stocks that are kind of making headlines you need to be aware of. And I think there's some interesting ones out there. One of the things I want to really make sure you do, I really want you to take a look at the videos that we've been doing for Trigger Point Research. It serves a couple of purposes. Number one, it's educational about stocks and some of the ways to look at stocks in a different way. When we're looking at, as I say, an X-ray of the actual price action and where there is true support and resistance and the algorithms that we use to come up with that. But more importantly, it gives you a different viewpoint of what a stock could do. For example, when we talked about Questcor last week and looked at the stock and said, you know, when you look at this, it's in a kind of a precarious point where the potential for it to move in either direction is there. But we looked at the fact that there was decent support and it was holding up really well. After a few days, it got hit. And one of the things that was showing through from this was that, hey, if you took a shot on the long side here, there was an opportunity to make a decent amount of money in a very quick time because there was very little resistance, as we see it, when looking at the true price action and the buying action of who was picking up shares and when they weren't, okay? Number one. Number two, on the downside, we knew that our point of line in the sand, the kind of the level where we'd say, hey, this is the level, this is the support that if it goes down below there, you get out of the trade. So this way, you had the opportunity to be in on the trade. At the same time, if it broke down, you know what? You weren't taking that much of a loss. But, you know, if you did nothing, okay, there's plenty of stocks out there, but this was a good opportunity to see if it could break and move higher because of the general setup that was happening. So you can go over to triggerpointresearch.com, and you can click on the right-hand side towards the middle. There's something that says setup videos. And you can also go to YouTube, look up Trigger Point Research on YouTube, and there's a whole series there. Check those out. They're very quick, 4 minutes, and I think they'll give you a lot of insight into what we're thinking. And again, these are just setups. These are not actual alerts because these are things that may or may not go. We may alert them, may not, depending on if the algorithm brings together all the different possibilities. But these are ones that are coming up and bubbling up to the top or the bottom of the list on the short side. So make sure to check those out. And you'll be able to find those if you follow us on Twitter, of course. You'll be able to see those when they come out, or if you just subscribe to them on YouTube, I suppose. All right, a couple of stocks that I wanted to mention. Now, in particular, there's two that I thought I'd just throw by you here because there is some technical setups, and now we have a backdrop of some information. Now, whether or not we like a particular magazine or whether or not we like a particular news source, some of them hold sway over markets and investors. We know that. Well, one of them is Barron's, and I've kind of bashed them here and there, and we've talked about them. But Barron's has a cover piece on Tesla. I'm talking about how the fact that the battery prices need to come down, and when you look at the amount of cars they really need to produce over this period of time, which is being projected by the company and Elon Musk himself, and they say, well, something's wrong here. It just doesn't work. Now, what I found fascinating was that they were so negative on it. They're talking about a 50% decline in the stock due to the information that they find very difficult to believe. You know, the outlook, the possibilities, the potential, etc. Now, we do know that Tesla had made a nice number on their last earnings compared to what expectations were, but still we know that the company is in its infancy and it's growing, and the hope is that they will in fact become more of a household type of item. But the question then was, okay, if they're going to become a household name in terms of people that are going to be buying this, it has a $90,000 base sticker price on one of the series, and then you can go up from there, and then they need to bring this down to a reality, the mass market, if they really want to do that. And if they do that, then what's going to happen is that they're going to have margin squeeze and they're not going to make as much money because, well, simply things and parts cost too much. Now, I've always said that, hey, when the batteries become lighter, when they become more efficient, when there is a lower price tag on the car, I'll look at it. But right now, it's questionable because of the charging station issue, the amount of the potential distance you have that you can travel with it, and on top of that, there is the price tag that is a real barrier to entry. Now, even though that Tesla's doing some of their own work to create very attractive leasing programs, etc., you still have to wonder what's going to happen with the stock when a Barron's article, front page article, comes out with the idea that there's going to be a 50% drop. Now, on top of that, you look at where Tesla's been trading, over this 196 to 110, back and forth. If you look at the charts and you look at the way we look at things in terms of the potential for the move. Now, again, we're talking about, when I talk about these charts and the x-rays and we're talking about the potential move with the market profile, we're talking about a short period of time. We're talking about, days, weeks, not talking about next 2 years. But when you look at that, there is a gigantic hole, fast zone, we call it, that it looks like there is this potential to drop down through or, frankly, move right up through. You know, 96, 97 is a break point. If it breaks down by there, and you know, you can really see a rush down. Now, one of the things that you do see and you have to pay attention to is a lot of times when these articles come out, you'll see that there is a big swoon on the stock because anybody that is really paying attention to this and using this as their guide will say, hey, you know what? I'm not sticking around for a 50% drop. So the first day or so, they're going to see that drop. And then what you'll see is that they come in behind it, and you'll see a short squeeze because there is a lot of short still in the stock. And you'll see this rush up pretty well and fake everybody out and say, oh, things aren't so bad. What does Barron's know and all that? And then the potential is you'll see either continuation of the move down or something else. It was a pretty damning article, I will tell you, from the excerpts that I read and some of the things. I don't buy the magazine, but I get it through other sources. We get the summaries, et cetera. And I would say that it would be, if you're interested in trading now, you know, talking about over a few days, over a few weeks, there's an interesting opportunity here because we are seeing that there was a lot of optimism built into this. And the amount of players that are in this, both short and long, will have a nice battle coming up over the next few weeks. So take a look at Tesla. I think it'll be very interesting. I'll put some charts up throughout the week. Maybe we'll do a video on it too. Ulta Cosmetics also is coming up this week. They're going to be reporting earnings. And I'm interested in seeing that. We don't own the stock. We don't own Tesla either on either side. Ulta is a name that we've been watching, and it's a name that has been doing very well. Historically, they had some hiccups in their earnings over time, but it's a company that, generally speaking, has their act together. It's a makeup and personal care product, higher end, not high end, but you know, nice. It's not a Walgreens for their products, but it's a, you know, they have a nice business model, cash flow, and the stock generally has a good following. Now we'll take a look at that ULTA. I definitely want to see that because I want to see how the consumers, in particular women, are doing when it comes to that, because that's a really good indicator of the pace of sales and consumption, consumer expenditures. So Ulta is going to be something I'm going to be watching very closely. Now, like I said, we have a lot of people coming up on the next several shows, so I want you to make sure to keep in touch. Ask Andrew at The Disciplined Investor if you have any questions, if you want me to answer a question that you have, and possibly if it's something that I think that everybody will find of interest, we'll put on the show. And stay tuned because, of course, Scott O'Neill will be here next week, and he has always great information to share. If you want us to manage your money, hey, we're available for that too. Go look at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Check out the TDI Managed Growth Strategy. Just click on it, and you'll be able to fill out a quick form and then see a 12-minute virtual tour. And if you're thinking that, hey, do I want to be in the market? Do I want to be out of the market right now? You know, we're both short and long, and we use a variety of different strategies on this. It's a trading strategy. It's an aggressive trading strategy. $50,000 minimum will get you that and all sorts of other features because we give a private client website and communication and transparency, and you have your own account, and it's good stuff. But if you want to find out more, check it out. And until then, I'll see you next week. Thanks for joining me. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.